I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Something or someone is missing in Mexico. While there are no reliable statistics on crime, there are estimates that close to 10 people are kidnapped every day. Most are robbed, a number of them are killed, and some even after a ransom has been paid. Mexican newspapers say gangs have even taken to kidnapping dogs and demanding $1,000 for their return. But what's missing, it seems, is a bit of political courage. It was 4 years ago today when Vicente Fox swept aside the long-standing Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, with his promise of openness and an end to corruption. But neither Fox nor his rivals seem to have what it takes to tackle Mexico's growing crime wave. Many say the problem is within the police force itself. This hour, crime, corruption, and a search for courage in Mexico. What will it take to give people there a sense of security? Why is it that institutional corruption is so difficult to overcome? We'd like to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we'll start today with Time Magazine's correspondent in Mexico, Dolly Mascareñas, is joining us now from Mexico City. Hello, Dolly.
Hello, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for joining us. Dolly,
I
wonder if you can tell us the story. I was just reading a précis about it. The story of the two brothers who were kidnapped and killed, Vicente and Sebastian, the young men in their 20s.
They were in their late 20s. They were young men, very successful, very good sons. That's what their family describes them, of course. And they a ransom was paid of $5 million. And after the ransom had been paid, they found the bodies in a trash dump. So that really made people extremely angry. And when the family was going to the funeral, the family that was left, that's a mother, a father, and a sister, they were robbed. And right now, the family is threatened. They have been threatened. The daughter has been threatened. So they are very, very scared.
Now, when you talk about a $5 million ransom, you're talking about people who are pretty wealthy in Mexico City if they have that kind of money to pay. Are we talking about a kidnapping crime wave that is affecting just wealthy people or others as well?
No, it's affecting everyone. And they ask $5 million because these people had a BMW distribution agency. It's not that they had this money. They had to gather it. I mean, they had to get loans and things. But it's affecting everybody. They are asking $1,000. They are asking 10,000 pesos, the equivalent. They are asking whatever people can give them, or they take them in what's called express kidnappings. That means they attack you, put you in the trunk of your car, take you around all the ATMs available, and they just clean your accounts.
Now, Dolly, would someone like yourself have to take precautions to make sure that that didn't happen to you? Are people doing that sort of thing?
Yes, we are. I mean, the embassies have given us guidelines. And, yes, we are not carrying a lot of credit cards. We are just carrying one credit card. We are having some precautions, changing our schedules, not driving the same way, the same streets every day, being careful, trying to not drive alone at night, using big avenues. And, of course, they ask you to have a cell phone on your trunk or a light or having water in case that you are kidnapped, because they usually put you in the trunk of your car. Now, that some people do that, some others don't. That's how it goes.
Dolly, we see a lot of big marches and protests in newspaper and magazine photographs. There was one this week in Hong Kong. They're often in capital city, Washington, D.C., here. But people are telling me that the march that took place in Mexico City this past weekend was something unusual for that city.
Absolutely. This is the first. I've been in Mexico since 1985, and there were marches. There had been a great march in 88. There were marches in 94, in 97, but nothing like this one. Even when the war in Iraq happened, people didn't take to the streets or they didn't make demonstrations. This is really a first. I am told that people that have been living here forever, that what happens, they have only seen this amount of people when the Pope comes. You know, that's the only one that could have gathered all these people. This was the first. The march was impressive. it was mostly silent, or people were just clapping or saying Mexico, Mexico. And they sang the anthem, and it was really, really impressive.
Is there any one thing that the people themselves are saying? Are they saying to the president, you've got to fix this? Are they saying to the mayor of Mexico City? Are they? Is it the police they're pointing their finger at? Who do they blame?
They are blaming everybody. They are blaming the government. They are blaming the police. They are blaming the mayor. And they want something done. Society wants something done. They are getting together and they are demanding that this ends, that the law is applied. 97-98% of the causes of the crime cases go unsolved in Mexico. It's terrible. If you compare that to Tokyo, in which 98% of the cases are solved, it's ridiculous.
And when people say a lot of this is tied up with corruption inside the police force, in your view, is that an accurate claim?
Yes, it is. Because the police has very low salaries, because it has been a story of a history of corruption, in Mexico. And everybody is involved. You have special police. We just had yesterday specially trained police, and they were robbing trailers. It's amazing. They caught them, and they were the ones that were robbing trailers. And you have sometimes the security details that know everybody, or most of the people that can afford it, have security details now. And it's also part of these security details that are involved in crime.
You mean I would hire a personal guard to protect myself, but then that guard ends up being a part of a criminal gang that says, hey, you want to take a look at this guy?
Well, yes, because probably you'll end up going to the bank with him, or maybe sending him to the bank to pay your accounts. People are a little bit loose, so that's also the idea. If you have a security guard, don't show them all your jewels, or don't show them how much money you have. But, for instance, private universities in Mexico have a parking lot for the security details.
Dolly, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dolly Mascareñas is Time Magazine's correspondent in Mexico, joining us there on the phone from Mexico City. Arturo Alvarado is now joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. He's a sociology professor from Mexico City and currently in the United States as a Fulbright Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. Arturo is researching issues of public security and democracy in Mexico. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Arturo, what is wrong with a society where crime, this kidnapping in particular, can reach such epidemic levels?
Well, first of all, we have to really, assess what is happening with kidnapping and all kinds of crime in Mexico City and in the country. As you can see from the official statistics, crime wave started in the mid-90s, and it went blatant all the way until 2000, 2001, and then started to decline. And from that, what we have seen is waves of epidemics of different kinds of crimes. The last or the more recent one is this kidnapping they talk about, the express kidnappings. Mm-hmm. And there are some other important issues, like there was an epidemic of assault and robbery and rapes in public transportation in Mexico during December and January, and it also grew a major concern. So the first point is that you have a situation here where, the crime rate was very high in the 90s. It's still high now, but it's going down. Why is this going down? We don't know. The police is the reason that this is going down? I don't believe so. I think there are some other reasons that explains the way this crime is going.
But tell me, Arturo, do you trust the statistics that you see?
No. Second, the main problem with statistics is official statistics only tells you what the government and the attorney generals and the local attorney generals are able to process as crimes or as delinquency, official delinquency. Mm-hmm. And if you see, this is the second important point, if you see all the major victimization surveys that newspapers, companies, and some new associations that are fighting for human rights and security in Mexico are doing surveys in order to see what is exact or more or less an appreciation or an estimation of the real crime trends. And what they have found is that for every crime that is reported in public records, there are between, I mean, for every crime, there are at least four more crimes that are not reported. People tend not to report crimes. But when you see these measures, you know that the problem is growing all through society.
People are not reporting these crimes because they don't trust the police or because
They don't trust the judiciary. They don't trust the police. They know that whatever they do is going to cost them. Most of these issues about reporting the crime and going through the process is going to aggravate the conditions of the victims. And in the end, as Dolly was saying at the beginning, I mean, 97% of the crimes that are reported go without a punishment. Which is not, I mean, it's not that all these crimes were real crimes. It's just the way that the Attorney General and the judiciary process these files. Well, just to give you an example, in Mexico City, and this varies from, I mean, areas of the city and also from different social sectors, but the probability of being victimized in the last 5 years in Mexico City in the official records is like almost 1% for every 100 person, only 1% will have been victimized in the city. But if you go to this service, more than 40% of the population of Mexico City have suffered a crime during the last 5 years. So this is, this tells you the last point that I just want to point. People's perception of crime, it's probably the most important personal concern is personal security that they are claiming. They are claiming that the state is not protecting them.
Now, this is the one point that I wanted to help get you to help us with, because I know you're studying this. Here in the United States, there have been occasions in years past when the newspapers and television stations report a lot of crime and people go, oh, my goodness, crime is up. Whereas, in fact, normally, you know, it's crime is not up. It's just that it makes a lot of headlines. Now, some of the politicians in Mexico are saying that's what's going on, that there's really no increase in crime. There's just a lot more reporting about crime.
And that's
crime.
The problem is you just see the official figures. For instance, look at what the Attorney General is doing in Mexico City. All his reports during the last 4 years says that crime has been substantially reduced in the city. And there's no way to prove that he's saying the truth when you go to the streets.
Especially when you're talking to people and everybody has, as you say, one of these experiences themselves or they know someone.
And what is interesting on the march on last Sunday is that you see there were nearly 300,000 people. This is an unusual thing for this kind of crime. I mean, these people was claiming personal security at the streets. If you consider that this is more or less 10% of the population of Mexico City in the streets claiming that the government is not working, then you can see the effect on the society. And you can talk that probably, I mean, not this 10%, but another 40% was also protesting silently in the city that day. They really want the government to do something about this issue.
Okay, and that's where we'll pick it up when we come back. Connection listeners, it used to be when we talked about crime waves in Latin America, we were talking about kidnapping in Colombia. Now it seems that this is the principal problem for not just Mexico City, but the entire country. What is it? What's the root of the lawlessness that leads to that? And what can be done about police corruption if, in fact, that is a principal problem here? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you. If you have any personal experiences with this, we'd also like to hear your observations on the problem. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Digging in a little bit this morning on the news this weekend of the big public protest in Mexico, drawing world attention to a wave of crime, carjackings, particularly kidnapping in that country. With us on the program, Arturo Alvarado. He's with us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. He works as a sociology professor at El Colegio de Mexico in Mexico City, but he's currently a Fulbright Fellow working on a project at the Woodrow Wilson International Center's Mexico Institute in Washington, D.C. We're going to go straight to the phone lines to Durham, North Carolina, and James is joining us from there. Hello, James.
Hi, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Now, I understand James is not, in fact, your real name. You've asked that we not even use your first name because you have some concerns about speaking about this subject. Is that right?
Yes, correctly. Yeah.
Fair enough. Tell me your story. What happened? What was it that you wanted to tell us?
Well, first of all, crime in Mexico City has history. it comes from, you know, many, many years of neglecting our educational system, our police, and our political system itself. And all this is a consequence of the PRI. I used to live there until I was 25 years old, and crime in Mexico City at that time was pandemic. And was pandemic not only because of the criminals, but also for the police department.
Okay, but James, but Mr. Fox has been in power for 4 years now. You would think he would have started to change things if that was
exactly
his promise.
Exactly. And I believe that right now he is in really his hands are tied. He is not able to, you know, destroy all these criminal elements that are right now in Mexico City because of the fact that the city is governed by another political party.
Before we get too political here, though, what I would like to do is find out what happened to you, to your family.
Well, my father was kidnapped. We pay heavily, a heavy ransom for his return. And we were completely financially destroyed. And this is, for us, the only thing that is that they returned him intact. And the stories go along.
And you know, did you or family then all move to the United States?
No, only myself. And I moved before all this happened. I moved when I was 23. I'm now, right now, you know, 42.
And how's your family now? I mean, having been kidnapped once, are people pretty well left alone?
No, not at all. Not at all. What happens is that, of course, you know, for the rest of your life, and, you know, my brothers, my sisters, my mother, my father, and our nephews and children, they are all living in this kind of jail in which every time you step into the street, you are with this feeling that sooner or later something is going to happen to you again. And to tell you the truth, this is not a way of living. But let me, go back into what I think Professor Alvarado is saying clearly, is that in Mexico we politicize everything. And this is one of the reasons, you know, this protest came alive because the people are really tired of this continuous politicization of the situation, the criminal situation in Mexico City. And this is something that really is going to, sooner or later, anyone, any party is going to pay for.
I'm glad you actually brought up the politicization, James. I thank you for your call, and I want to go back to Arturo specifically on that point. The day or the days after the big march, Arturo, the yes. president was saying, "Oh, the march was a good thing. It shows that democracy is flourishing in Mexico." And his rival, the mayor of the capital city, said, "No. The march was a bad thing. It's a political stunt." These people aren't speaking about what the public are concerned about. They're not addressing the real problem.
I think you're right. This is the main problem. There is this political dispute between the mayor of Mexico City and the president for popularity and for the presidential race. And in the middle of this thing, both of them are not doing their job. They are using the political all the resources that they have in their government for their own political advantages, and they are also using the budget for this issue. And I want to jump into one point in this whole thing about what are the federal and the local government in Mexico City doing to fight crime? There are two things that are important to look at in here. First, there are resources. There is a lot of money. Just to give you one example, in Mexico City, the total allocation of money for public security issues is that it comes from from the payrolls and all the issues that you had to run for the Secretaría de Seguridad Pública, the Ministry of Public Security, plus the Attorney General in Mexico City, plus managing jails and other institutions like even the National Commission and the State Commission of Human Rights.
Okay,
spending
let me clarify
35% of the budget of the Mexico City.
So for the problem of corruption that we see in some countries when the police officers are paid just a pittance, that's not the problem in Mexico?
It's not only the problem. And you know, and there are studies of corruption that the amount of money that you pay to your personnel is not related to whether they become less or more corrupt. It's not the point.
So they are being well
paid.
The policemen are being well paid, Arturo?
I mean,
reasonably
in relative
well paid?
Terms, I mean, considering all conditions, social conditions in Mexico City, they are better paid than in other jobs.
Yeah.
That's the main point. I mean, it's not that they are well paid. Everybody claims in Mexico that they are not well paid because if you see the standard salaries are very low. And that's correct. That's right. I mean, we live in a situation that the personal income is still very low. I mean, personal income is around $4,000, $4,500 a year for the average population. A policeman in the best of the conditions in Mexico City, is making like $500 before taxes. And he has to, I mean, he has to maintain his family, and he has to have these 12-hour shifts, and he has to pay part of his equipment, and he has to support a hazardous job. So you have to understand that the conditions to work as a policeman are not easy. Then they don't have benefits. They don't have a real insurance policy, a good one. And they don't have housing. Their families have to fight for, for maintaining themselves. And then in the end of this thing, this is a job that is, badly valued in all the society. I mean, police is not the job that someone would really like to have in Mexico.
Yeah, historically.
In contrast with some other places like in the United States.
Historically, not a lot of respect. I think that's something that we need to pick up later in the program. But I want to go to a call, another call to Louisville, Kentucky now. And Susan's with us. Hi, Susan. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. My husband grew up in Mexico City. And last year, his brother-in-law was kidnapped by two police officers. And they didn't do it for ransom. They basically were just trying to get his credit cards, and they kept taking him around to ATMs and making him withdraw money, and then finally beat him up. And they assumed that they had killed him, and they basically dumped his body in a swamp and left him. And luckily, he was alive, and he survived the incident. But I think that it was very depressing for my husband's whole family, because at the moment they're all living in the U.S. because they all went to college here, but they all had hopes of going back to Mexico at some point. And now they know that they can never do that. And I think that's a real loss for Mexico, because you're basically having a huge brain drain. And you have a lot of very well-educated people who love the country and would love to live there.
But are not.
But are refusing to take the chance.
Susan, just help me with the end of this story. Your husband's brother-in-law survived the beating and clearly was able to say, yes, I was kidnapped. Did he ever identify the police officers? Did he ever try to pursue this within the judicial system?
Well, what happened is he is living in the States right now, and he was just back visiting his parents.
Right.
And he basically walked back to his parents' house, was able to tell his dad about the whole situation. His dad knew someone on a different police force, not on the same police force that these two officers were from. And they talked to that officer, but then, my brother-in-law ended up having to leave the country immediately and come back to the States because he was afraid for his safety.
In many ways, this is like one of the cases that doesn't end up on the books, that doesn't end up investigated.
Then. Exactly.
Susan, I want to thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Take care of that lovely-sounding baby, will you?
Thanks.
1-800-423-8255. Arturo, it's an interesting point that Susan raises, that the people, the educated professional people in the country are being driven out by this.
Well, yes and no. This is true that people is migrating to the United States a lot, but it's not the only reason. And the drain doesn't go for that. It goes for the differences, the differential situation of salaries and wages between the United States and Mexico. If you can get a job here with a BA or a PhD, you are more likely to have better, living conditions here than in Mexico presently. But it's not that easy to find a job in that way. But I want to point on one thing that she was talking about when her family was kidnapped. And this is, they were policemen. She's telling us, a true and terrible story. And if you go to the Mexico City and the national news all the time, for every gang that the president, for every gang that the attorney general or any other police caught, there is at least one member of the gang that is either a former police or an active police. So this is a real important problem. Then if you go to the National Commission of Human Rights Complaints and to most of the state commissions of human rights complaints in Mexico, up to 40% of the complaints are complaints against police behavior. People is starting to fight crimes because they say, police tortures people. Police makes arbitrary detentions. Police integrates false lawsuits. They do all kinds of illegal activities. And this is the main issue that is a real concern. People is fed up with this idea that the government is really doing something and using as a tool of fighting crime,
right,
criminals. And this is the main point. There has not been, not in our proposal, but the political will of going to in an important and substantive police reform in Mexico.
I'd like to bring Robert Vernick into the conversation now. He's joining us on the phone from Mexico City. He works as a consultant on policing and criminal justice in Latin America. In Mexico City, specifically, he co-founded the Institute for Security and Democracy a year ago, and through his work there, he promotes police reform as a human rights issue. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thanks to you. Good morning.
I'm wondering, Robert, if you have figured out what this deep structural flaw is inside Mexico's police system that makes way for so much corruption that persists.
Well, the Mexico police, I mean, as an institution or a set of institutions around the country, don't really function like institutions. What I mean by that is, they don't seem to measure or learn from their own experience. They don't seem to have really set formal policies and rules, including in many places, no written laws that govern what they do. And so they're really the sort of sum total of a bunch of informal agreements and practices and tendencies, most of which are pretty negative. That's the sum total of the police, not a set of sort of institutional policies that have been developed in a professional manner. And that shouldn't surprise anyone because the police as an institution, in quotation marks, basically have been an arm of the political elite for an awfully long time, and their mandate and loyalties and imperatives have been to serve those elites and not to perform professional functions of securing the public. And So
10 or 15 or 20 years ago, if someone robbed my house and I was a middle-class Mexican, I wouldn't naturally go to the police and report it and expect it to be dealt with. They're too busy looking after the elite?
Well, yeah, although depending on where you fall in society, you might have an expectation that you are one of the clientele of the police and would be protected.
Right.
And it's not to say that the police didn't do anything, but they did so based on a logic that was particular and political.
So where do you start in transforming the police into something where the people trust them to look after their security interests?
I think you do three things. I think you start looking to promote based on merit and try to find people who, despite the lack of a positive environment for learning, people have actually learned quite a bit through experience. You incorporate, basic notions of supervision, formal supervision based on, rules and regulations that are known to everybody, and accountability. And you start informing the public about what you're doing, in particular what you're doing to clean your own house, because gaining the public's trust is important since most crimes have to be solved by somebody in the community giving you information, giving you evidence. And if you don't have the public's trust, it really doesn't matter that much what else you do, because they're not going to give you the facts you need, the clues you need to start solving crime.
Let's go to Savannah, Georgia now. Leah's joining us on the phone from there. Leah, thanks for calling.
Thank you. I said I really don't know where to begin. I lived in Mexico for 10 years, from 1986 to about the middle of 1995. And what people don't understand about the police forces in Mexico is the general public doesn't look on a police force like we do here in the United States, that they help the community. You can go to a policeman for aid. That's not done in Mexico. You avoid the police at all costs.
Why?
Because they are so corrupt. And the problem is there are so many police organizations that have overlapping jurisdictions or just they mandate themselves. This is my jurisdiction, my territory.
Give me a specific example, though, Leah. If somebody steals my car, I'm living in Mexico City, I mean, I wouldn't automatically go to the police to report a stolen car. How could the corruption get at me then?
No, you don't. You just don't deal with the police unless you have a deep pocket. Then you can go to the police and you can say, someone stole my car. Here's so much money. Try to get my car back. If you have a traffic accident, say you rear end somebody, the two drivers are standing there, the police show up, The person with the deepest pockets and the most money is going to be written up as the victim in this accident, no matter what. And the other person is more than likely going to have his vehicle confiscated. My brother-in-law had that happen to him.
And the person with the deepest pockets is going to have to pay his way out of that, and the money stays with the police?
He just gives it to the police officer there at the scene, and the police officer writes up the accident report in favor of the person who paid him off. If you've got money, you can get anything done in Mexico. Absolutely anything. For Americans who want to live down there, you can get a birth certificate. you can go and get legal papers to live there. You can get land, which is...
Let's not give people too many ideas here, Lee. Listen, I want to go back to Robert. Thanks for your call, Lee. I want to go back to Robert Vernick here. Robert, you were there for the protest. When people take to the street, as they did, is that a gesture of, like, enough of exactly what Leah's describing, or are they actually presenting mandates or ideas to the politicians, to the security people, saying, look, this has got to change?
Well, yeah, it's both things. I mean, there's clearly just, a kind of visceral cry for change. And the sense that, unless we do this massively, the people in power are not listening to us. I mean, public protest is really a sort of time-honored tradition in Mexico. And there's a combination. There's a number of voices out there, and there's a number of proposals floating around. I think people are starting to realize that only with concrete suggestions are they going to cut through the kind of, bureaucratic paralysis and start talking about very specific things. I think the danger is if public concern over crime translates into just another round of sort of hardline proposals rather than getting at some of the institutional problems we have, then we really won't move forward. And if people reacting to this sort of sense of urgency among the public start thinking about quick fixes, then we're really lost, because I don't think there are any quick fixes for this sort of problem.
All right. It is a question of public trust, Connection listeners, and we'd like to hear your observations, your ideas on this subject. 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join us. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, 1-800-423-8255, to join our conversation this hour about crime, corruption, and political courage in Mexico. With me on the program, Arturo Alvarado. He's currently a Fulbright Fellow working on a project at the Woodrow Wilson International Center's Mexico Institute in Washington, D.C., and he's an expert on the rule of law, public security, justice, and democracy in Mexico. Robert Vernick's also with us. He's a law and public policy professor at CIVE. It's an academic center for economic research and education, joining us on the line from Mexico City. We're going to our next call in North Carolina. This is Roger joining us from Windale. Hi, Roger.
Hi there. Yesterday, you had a show dealing with the judicial system in Iraq. And, of course, anybody who pays attention knows that Iraq is ruled by mobs. And I was wondering if Mr. Chernick could replace the word elites and talk about the four mob families that absolutely control everything that goes on in Mexico.
No, that's a good question. I was wondering myself, Roger, last night, reading up on this kidnapping wave, whether or not it was professional criminals, people being paid off all the way up to those four famous cartel families that you're talking about, or whether or not this is, sort of low-grade gangs, everybody getting in on the act. Arturo, can you start with us on that?
Yeah, okay. I'll start by saying that nobody really knows exactly who are all these gangs. There are different types of gangs that are dedicated to kidnapping now, from police organizations, from former gangs that were either part of narcotraffic or whatever, to really simple new groups of youngers that they really know and they really want to get some cash, and they are finding this way easy to get it. So there are different kinds of gangs, and this problem is that the issue is getting so easy, and the impunity is so blatant that the people is really engaging in this thing. But bottom line, and this is one of the problems that we have in the criminal system in Mexico, there is not a clear record of criminals or perpetrators. Not even the federal or the local authorities know exactly who are these criminals.
Robert,
do you have right things?
Do you have anything to add to that, Robert?
Well, you know, I think the only question, and sort of an answer to the issue that Roger was raising is, you know, and this is something, you know, people have studied PICS over a long time, really look at as the basic issue, is the government or are the governments wholly owned subsidiaries of organized crime, or are they separate entities where the power and sort of influence of organized crime can often thwart and condition what the government tries to do in terms of public security? And that's a, you know, if your options for answering the question are those two, then you know the situation's pretty serious. I tend to think, you know, it varies. Some places it's hard to separate the government from organized crime, and other places, you know, they're in battle. But I think the bottom line is that there's an enormous web of organized crime, and although in particular the kidnapping issue that is sort of facing everybody these days may be the result of the disintegration of some of the larger groups, and the market has sort of shifted into a bunch of smaller organizations that are less professional, less predictable, and that may be why people are more frightened as a result. It's not as easy to figure out who's likely to be a victim. But the fact is the influence of organized crime reaches into all the institutions, makes it very hard to imagine a clear path towards a much more secure situation.
Back to the lines, to Virginia Beach, Virginia now, and Pete's with us on the line. Pete, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I agree with what the last caller was saying, and I think that the people in the country feel that they don't trust their institutions. I was traveling in a small town, and my friend's dog was kidnapped. And we went to the mayor, we went to the chief of police.
You know, I have to stop you, Pete. When I mentioned that at the beginning of the program, it's something that I'd read, but I didn't really believe it. Your friend's dog was kidnapped.
Yes, and people came up to us and asked us for money. So we knew that the dog hadn't just run off. We knew that somebody was holding the dog, and nobody in the town would help us. And then some citizens came and said, talk to the padre. And I saw that it was Sunday, and I saw the padre walking across the square, and I went and told him the story, and he got very angry, and he yelled out so loud that everyone in the square could hear it, this is very ugly, and you'll get your dog back, don't give anybody a peso. And in about 10 minutes, somebody came running up with a dog on a rope, handed us the rope, and ran away. And the people that we talked to told us we were wasting our time by going to the mayor and going to the chief of police.
And so what's the message? It's that the church is in control?
Well, in this particular town, I think the padre wielded a lot of power, but I think that the people in the town felt that in a case where there's a crime, you're wasting your time by going to the chief of police, going to the mayor, going to the officials.
Pete, I thank you for your story. Robert, it bears out in many ways what you're saying about how the situation changes from town to place, and it's difficult to make these kinds of generalizations about who in fact holds the power.
That's right. But I think what the common lesson is that what you'd look for in a sort of organized, institutionalized policing public security system is that there's an obvious place to go and an obvious process for getting relief. And what our caller's experience tells you is that forget the formal rules. In each place, there's going to be some informal answer, and that's going to be much more effective, which is why people tend not to look to the police for a response.
To Chapel Hill, North Carolina next. Karen is joining us. Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I am a third-generation Mexican-American. My great-grandmother immigrated here many years ago, but I still stay very much in touch with my cousins in Mexico and still visit and travel there. And one of the things that's really clear to me is that in talking with them, that apparently in order to even become a police officer, you have to pay for that privilege. My understanding is the going rate is about $20,000 to become a police officer.
That's not tuition. That's a bribe, right?
It's a bribe. So you must, you basically.
Why don't you use that to go to MIT then?
the expectation is you make the money back in the bribe. They call the bribe the bite. Okay, that's what the Mexicans call it when you get pulled over and you have to pay your way out of a ticket or something. And then the other story, which I find is very telling about the church, is I was in Merida, where my family is from, and a police officer pulled me over for some really, it wasn't a traffic violation, it was his figment of his imagination, but I played up that I couldn't speak much Spanish, and I said, look, I don't understand what I've done wrong, but I think I need to call my uncle, who's the priest down at the cathedral, which he was the priest at the cathedral, and all of a sudden, boy, he did not want my uncle getting involved. I said, you know, I need this family intermediary to explain what I did wrong. And all of a sudden, he did not want the bribe. He wanted me to leave, and he wanted me to leave quickly. So there are some powers that be get you out of it to some degree, but the church clearly has some authority. And I think part of it is there really is some, you know, the idea of sin and this is not acceptable, and the social control that comes out of the church is very much a part of what we were just discussing here about that kind of power over the people.
Well, Karen, let me take the point that you made about the bite, the amount of money that it might cost you to be allowed to apply for a job within the police force, and turn to Arturo here, because, I mean, it moves this whole notion of where do you begin the fix even further back in the whole system, Arturo.
Yeah, it used to be, I mean, well known that some people pay bribes to get into the police or to get the uniforms and everything. But there are two new things that are important to understand now here. To begin with, people that is getting into the federal preventive police, that is the police that the president is building up, is getting to a different way of recruiting, training, and monitoring. So this is not really happening. And I think it gets to the point to be absurd. If you have $25,000 to get into the police department, why don't you just do a business or make another investment or go to a nice school, pay your fees, and then get a nice degree in law, and then you just fight criminals and police, and you just get, you get a benefit on that thing.
Well, my assumption would be that the $25,000 investment is going to pay you more if you get at that level of corruption within a security force, no?
Well, yeah, but if you see, what pays off, if you have that amount of money, you better use your money in a different way. Of course, there was this big issue. But now, when you go to the present conditions of being a policeman, you know that it's also very likely that you will get involved in crime, that you will get involved in illegal activities. And even though it's very difficult for you to get caught, in the long run, your life conditions are in danger. So this is a hazardous job. You have to understand that these things. There are lots of problems of being police, and it's not only that you really want to, get into criminal activities by using the police uniform. So the problem is selecting police, the right people to be police. You have, as Robert was saying, this is a long story of this problem. You had, when you went to start the reform, you had to cut the things in two parts. You want to have new policemen that are really well trained, that are really for the job. And you have to do something with the people that is inside. So you had to monitor them. You had to, give them, just merit to really promote people and keep people into their payrolls. And people, you know that they've been having problems. You have to do something with them. It's like you have to treat these things in separate ways.
Okay, but Robert, somebody at some point needs to stand up and take the courageous stand. And I'm not sure, even at this point in the program, if that's the one thing that's lacking. While the politicians pay lip service to the interests of the people in Mexico, in Mexico City, is there anyone who is saying, right, I have a plan, and I'm actually going to do something about this?
There are people saying they have plans and that they're going to do something. Mexico City has taken some fairly strident moves in that direction. I'm not sure that they're all the right ones. There is no one that comes to mind that has said cleaning up the police is the root of the problem, and I am prepared to take the political and personal hits mm-hmm. necessary to make that happen. And there's probably not anyone around that has their fingers on all the sort of strings of influence in order to be able to actually bring that about. It's not an easy thing to do. So it's one thing to say, it's another thing to do it. I don't see anybody who has really stood up in quite that way on either front, words or deeds. But I do think it's what's necessary.
And Arturo, I go back to something that Robert was saying a little bit earlier about, trying to decide if the government is, a client of the forces that run crime in Mexico.
I will tend to dispute that thing. Of course there is organized crime in Mexico. Of course crime is interrelated to some government activities. But I wouldn't go to the point that the present federal and local governments are run through these cartels.
So you're saying that there is a fix there somewhere? Is the person with the courage there?
Yes. And it's not, let me just go to three points just to make propositions up to this point of the program. First, you would really have to have a police reform that goes to the point of recognizing two things. Police is part of the problem, but it's not the complete solution. You need good policemen to do the job, but not only to prosecute criminals, but also to prevent, to have more crime. We don't have this kind of police in Mexico, and this is going to be a long-term job. Cost politically is very costly. That's the main problem. Nobody wants to pay for this cost, not the president, not the mayor of Mexico City, not some other candidates. So there must be a way that society have to pressure for major political reforms. Second, there are resources and there are ways and there are international experiences of reforming this problem. How to go there? Part of the problem, again, is police reform. But then you know that police is not the only answer. It's the society. A society that has these levels of crime has several problems on interpersonal relations. You had to go and start working on prevention, education, and some other ways of conflict resolution programs, like in Colombia, right, in order to really start reducing the rates of crime.
Okay, well, we're near the end. Robert, just a quick last question to you. Is there any talk of a sort of vigilantism in Mexico taking root in the absence of any of the reliable law and order?
I haven't heard. No, I mean, I think the tendency in Mexico has been to sort of abdicate action and almost a fatalistic response to this is what happens. My sense is that vigilantism probably has been a common practice, maybe worse in the last decade, 15 years, outside the capital. I mean, I've heard rural accounts of this more than something inside. But it's safe to say that the courts and the public support somebody who shoots an assailant in Mexico City rather than someone who submits to one. There's no question that there's a sort of a public support for the notion of reacting on your own and giving a private response to crime.
Right.
I don't see it as a huge issue right now in the city.
Robert, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
Robert Bernix, co-founder of the Institute for Security and Democracy in Mexico City, and Arturo Alvarado. It was great having you with us. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Arturo is a sociology professor from Mexico City, currently a Fulbright Fellow at the Woodrow Wilson International Center in Washington, D.C. We also talked with Dolly Mascareñas, Time magazine reporter based in Mexico City. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.